Hello everyone and welcome back to the AirPod, the show that I would call the roller coaster of the royal world. It has been a slightly more subdued week. I think we kind of feel like we're back into a rhythm of sorts, Maggie. Would you agree?
I think as much of a rhythm as you can have right now. There was actually some, dare I say, like normal things that happened in the world of the royals this week.
Well, yeah, we've just had Prince Charles and Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, return from an overseas visit, which is, you know, it's been interesting because I think there was some excitement before the trip. They obviously went to Greece to mark the bicentenary of Greek Independence Day. There was excitement that it was a royal tour. But then I think at the same way, it kind of played out in the press over here in the same kind of low-key manner that we're used to seeing with Prince Charles's trips. So it in many ways, it kind of feels like we've gone back to normal.
Yeah. It's true. Even the fact that the trip happened, though, felt so normal. And the coverage was normal. I mean, all of a sudden, you're like, is this a glimpse of what's to come, the future, where it's not all, you know, pandemic and interview coverage all the time?
Exactly. I'm here for it. Absolutely. And, yeah. And of course, we had great news this week. We had the arrival of a baby. We'll get onto that in a second. Is. Buckingham Palace announced that they're hiring a diversity chief, or might be. We'll get into that in a second. The Cambridges joined other members of the royal family to mark our National Day of Reflection. Can you believe it's been 1 year since our first lockdown? I feel like I haven't gone anywhere. And then Prince Harry has a new title, in fact two of them, so we'll be diving into his new jobs. He is a working man, business cards and all, later on in the show, plus some updates on Archwell and what Meghan has been up to this week. But back to the baby news, Maggie, and you know how we love a baby story over here on the AirPod.
Give me a good baby story, we are good to go. I feel like this is like the double whammy baby year as well. Back-to-back births. This is so exciting.
Well, exactly. We're only months away from the arrival of baby Sussex number two. But before then, we had the great news that Zara Tyndall had given birth to a baby boy over the weekend just gone. And it was a very low-key announcement. Her husband, Mike, confirmed the news on his rugby podcast. It's called The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. And he sort of slipped it into a conversation with quite a few details about the birth itself.
I like how you describe that. Quite a few details. Were you surprised at some of the graphic revelations that he sort of surprised us with on this podcast?
You know, I'm so used to the very vague information that Buckingham Palace give us in a press release that I won't even characterize it. I won't even summarize it. I will just play you a clip from his show, and we'll digest afterwards.
Since this is unbelievable, how healthy? How bonny?
8 pounds 4. Very solid. Bonny. Arrived very quickly. Didn't make it to hospital. On the bathroom floor.
You're kidding me.
Start up.
Yeah.
Mate, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And dare I ask, how hands-on were you? Or did you have someone to kind of just direct?
Fortunately, Zara's friend Dolly is, who has been there. She's actually more important than I am at making sure that she's been at every three of my children's births. She was there and recognised that we wouldn't have got to hospital in time. So, yeah, it was run into the gym, get a mat, get into the bathroom, get the mat on the floor, towels down, brace, brace, brace.
So, yeah, royal baby born on the bathroom floor.
I loved this so much. It's kind of refreshing, right? Like you said, so much of the correspondence at Buckingham Palace is clearly, you know, 17 aides have poured through it. It's all highly edited and perfected and shortened to the point. And, you know, the way it comes out is on a pre-programmed sort of like their Instagram tweet or to the BBC or something. And this one was just the husband talking about in quite illuminated detail about his wife giving birth on the bathroom floor. That's a lot of personal information, even for like me or someone who isn't royal, to be giving out in public.
And a source close to the couple says that they're both doing very well at home, receiving lots of messages from the royal family members. And a Buckingham Palace spokesperson gave all the details in the sort of the official form, including the name, of course. Their son is called Lucas Philip Tindall. And of course, that middle name is a tribute to the Duke of Edinburgh, who I'm sure has been very much on their minds in the recent months. Buckingham Palace nice. Also say that the Queen and Philip are delighted at the news and are looking forward to meeting now their 10th great-grandchild when circumstances allow. So, I mean, that's quite a gang. That's quite a gang that the Queen has now. Eight grandkids. Let's talk about
eight grandkids, I was going to say, and 10 great-grandchildren and another on the way. I mean, that is, yeah, it's a gang. You're right. Oh, but I love this, too, because I just had the thought. I remember, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, and you mentioned how, you know, when it comes to health matters, what you always hear from the palace is that he's in good spirits. You know, that's what we heard about Philip for a month. He's in good spirits. And I love that the Tindalls are like, let me actually give you all the graphic detail you need. So she's on the bathroom floor and then the baby's coming. You're like, that's a lot more than just good spirits.
Well, listen, that's a story that now goes in the history books because, of course, baby Lucas
exactly.
is 22nd in line to the throne alongside his sisters, Mia and Lena. So they're on the list. It's not that close to the top, but they're on the list.
But there's a list and they're on it.
And all Buckingham Palace haven't been quiet at all this week because also we started the week with the news that they might be hiring a diversity chief. The news was first reported in Britain's Mail on Sunday and of course follows Harry and Meghan sharing their own experiences of racism in the royal family with Oprah. And of course, whilst we're all still talking about that, there are still many unanswered questions. Sources close to Buckingham Palace say that the institution is planning to appoint a diversity chief. Now, of course, this focuses very much on the inner workings of the palace. So that is the staff, the aides, the courtiers that we hear about. But it's kind of the first time or as close as they've come to admitting that there is perhaps a slight diversity crisis within the institution and that they really want that inner workings of the palace to represent modern day society. And in fact, I had a conversation with a source at the palace who said that it's something they're taking very seriously. You know, they say they have their policies and procedures and programs in place, but in their words, they would like to see more progress and feel that more work needs to be done. They say that we can always improve and we're not afraid to look at new ways of approaching it. That said, the reports that we saw in many of the British papers saying that they're hiring I think it was a diversity czar, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, are slightly off the mark because Buckingham Palace sources say that they're at the moment just considering hiring someone and they haven't quite announced plans yet. I find all of this quite interesting because we don't usually get palace guidance on staff hirings or like HR issues, and this is sort of a running theme. But it's very on and off. Sometimes we get a great amount of detail on something, you know, the Meghan bullying claims. We've had almost a running commentary on that from the palace, and now, of course, this conversation about sort of a more representative workplace at the palace. You know, I'm all for it. I think this is absolutely the right direction to be going. I'm curious to know how close this goes to members of the royal family, whether there's any kind of awareness training that may come in with that over the months ahead. I guess we'll find out.
Well, I'm curious what you make of the timing of this omit. I mean, obviously, race has become such a topic of interest when it comes to the royal family after Meghan and Harry's interview with Oprah and these allegations of racism. I mean, that is something that people are demanding we sort of get to the bottom of. And then all of a sudden you have this announcement from Buckingham Palace not long after those allegations and that bombshell was dropped. You know, the palace is sort of saying this has been in the works for a while, but the timing is also hard to ignore that they only announced the potential for this position after the interview. I mean, have you heard anything about that? Should we infer anything from the timing, or really is it really all just sort of coincidence?
I'm glad you reminded me of that because, of course, the palace did say that this is something, a conversation that had been happening internally since long before the Sussexes' interview came out. So, of course, it leaves the question, why now? And I think it's pretty obvious. You know, this is their way of touching on the subject without actually talking about the main issue or the claims made by the Sussexes at hand. But, you know, I think it's also worth pointing out that this isn't just them talking about racial diversity. It also includes the LGBTQI plus community, disability representation. And, you know, listen, I've gotten to know the sort of palace workplace quite well over the years. In some areas, it is actually pretty progressive, and in others, not so much. My question is really to anyone involved in this is, are they going to be making sure that that diversity is on every level? Because at the moment, whilst we may look at, say, household staff or more junior members of the palace workforce, if you want to call them that, it is getting a lot more diverse. But when we look at those really at the top, the private secretaries, the senior aides, those who are really in the day-to-day lives of members of the royal family, they're still pretty much lacks any form of representation whatsoever. And as we said on Good Morning America this week, it is generally a workplace of people who mostly come from sort of civil servant or military backgrounds, often sort of middle or upper class white British males. And, you know, I think that's going to be something that if they bring someone in this role is really going to have to focus on, because then maybe we could have avoided some of the issues that the Duchess of Sussex faced during her time, because I think there were times where people didn't, as Meghan said herself, people didn't quite understand the difference between rude coverage in the press and not dealing with that, and racist coverage and the sort of the need to do something about matters such as those. So, you know, I think this is a step in the right direction, but I don't know what it means on the whole.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned sort of the positions and more of a higher authority of power within the palace. And that's something that I heard a lot of, you know, when we were doing interviews after the interview as well with some, you know, sources that were close to working inside the palace. They kind of also the same thing that, you know, they could see Meghan walking in there and noticing the lack of diversity right away at the higher levels of power within the palace. And so, you know, listen, having a diversity czar, whatever you want to call it, is probably a good idea, not just for the, you know, the royal households and family, but, you know, if you really view the monarchy as a government body, as this institution, I mean, this is something that kind of all modern businesses have nowadays. If you, you know, want to progress and become a modern business or government body, you have to make sure that you reflect sort of the values and the culture of 2021. And so I think, you know, on one hand, it's almost shocking they haven't prioritized this already, considering so many organizations and companies have. But at the same time, listen, it's good they're doing it now. It's something that really all companies, government bodies, again, sort of any large organization should have this nowadays. And so it's good that they're at least, well, I guess they might be doing it, but it's good they're at least talking about it, I'll say.
Exactly. I think we certainly last year, throughout the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, we saw, especially in the US, a lot of big organizations announcing that they felt that they needed to do more within the workplace. And that's kind of something we've seen a lot of, especially within the sort of more older institutions. I don't think you can really get much older than the royal establishment, other than maybe the Royal Mint or Royal Mail or something. But I think there are also conversations that follow that, which is, you know, how do you actually make that work in the workplace? It's not just about awareness or a diverse workplace. It's also about taking it a step further and committing to being sort of anti-racist as an employer. Because, of course, research has shown that the way a company responds to diversity-related events that received widespread media coverage actually help their employees feel psychologically safe or contribute to feelings of racial discrimination and mistrust of authority within the organisation. So I think this is sort of step one, but to be anti-racist is to also acknowledge the permanence of racism throughout organisations or industries and communities and so on. So yeah, it's one step forward, and I'm looking forward to seeing the ones that follow. But steps in a slightly different direction this week. I don't know how quite segue from that.
But
that
was a tough segue. It's a tough segue. We have other things to talk about as well.
We saw the Duchess of Cambridge taking her steps back down the aisle at Westminster Abbey this week.
I see what you did there. That was good, Omid. That was really good. I want to acknowledge it.
For a slightly different purpose than her wedding, of course, which is almost 10 years ago. We will have a whole anniversary special on the AirPod later on, catching up and reliving some of those magic moments. But yes, this visit, it was earlier this week, was to Westminster Abbey, which has been kind of transformed into a vaccination centre, or at least a corner of it. There's an area at Westminster Abbey called Poets' Corner, and many poets and authors, past and, well, not present, but past, past and even further past, are either buried or there are memorials there for them. And so it's a very special place, but they've created this pop-up NHS General Practitioners Centre where they're administering something like 2,000 or so shots a week. And I think it's great. You know, I love seeing across the country how we've kind of transformed as much as possible into a vaccination centre. I've seen town halls, churches, the Abbey, you know, some of our sort of like most well-known landmarks and locations are all sort of in on this national drive to get the vaccinations going. And, you know, as you know, Maggie, the numbers are really high now.
Yeah, I mean, it's been incredible. I think the UK and the US are both just really pumping out, you know, getting vaccines in people. And it's been sort of an amazing thing to watch. You know, seeing people get the vaccine is kind of like this huge sigh of relief. It's almost an indescribable moment where it's like all of the angst and anxiety and, you know, fear of the last year, while a lot of it still, you know, there's a lot of still uncertainty. The fact that vaccines are getting rolled out is just... Yeah, it's a relief, right? It's like finally there's some light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully. And, you know, for a couple like Will and Kate that have been very vocal talking about coronavirus and, you know, trying to really sort of be the face of it here in the UK to see this vaccination center at Westminster Abbey, it's kind of just an incredible compilation of imagery, right? Like having it inside Westminster Abbey, seeing all these vaccinations go out, having Will and Kate there near the 10-year anniversary of their wedding, the visual story that tells is pretty impactful.
And of course, they're there for what our national day, what we called the National Day of Reflection, March 23rd. It was the one-year anniversary of our first lockdown, which of course the Queen famously led us into with that sort of across every platform public speech that she gave. And, you know, I think when you compare the state of the country now to then, we're in a very different place. It's like over 25 million across the country have now had at least their first vaccinations.
Yeah, and, more you know, than half of all adults.
I think that same positive feeling about all of this also is in the US as well. You know, we just had the news that Biden's sort of on pace to clear his goal of, what is it, 200 million coronavirus shots in his first 100 days, which is more incredible news. Yeah. And, you know, William and Kate weren't the only members of the royal family to acknowledge the National Day of Reflection. The Queen also sent flowers and a note to St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, where Prince Philip spent part of his hospital stay when he had his heart procedure. And she sent them a note and it said, "As we look forward to a brighter future together, today we pause to reflect on the grief and loss that continues to be felt by so many people and families and pay tribute to the immeasurable service of those who have supported us all over the last year." And around this time, William and Kate also took a moment out to actually have a sort of private moment of remembrance or reflection at the Abbey as well. So great to see all the royals out. And I think that, you know, as these engagements happen, I think the imagery, as you say, certainly gives an encouraging message to people.
There's something about the Queen writing her letters too, and maybe it's just because, you know, she's had this steady voice throughout history and, you know, has been the leader for decades. But when she speaks about coronavirus, I just feel like the whole nation pauses and listens. It's like this moment where no matter almost how you feel about the royal family or politics or the monarchy, it's like the Queen is speaking. And, you know, when she spoke last year, it really reminded you of the power that she has. And even in her message just then, you know, it's so simple and straightforward, but it's sort of, there's like this beautifulness in its simplicity and the fact that, you know, she wrote it and is still being this leader, even in her 90s, I find just incredible.
Absolutely. Well, we have a little bit more news on the Queen later on in the show, but first we'll take a break and then we'll be catching up with Prince Harry, or Chief of Impact Officer Harry, I should say, after a few messages from our sponsors. Welcome back. Well, it's almost a year since Harry and Meghan officially stepped away from their working roles. The anniversary of that is on March 31st. And I would say at this point, they almost feels like they've finished up setting up the empire that they plan to establish once they moved to the US. We've got the Archwell Foundation, the production company, the audio division, and now Harry's taken on a brand new job of his own, away from all of that, with a new title, Chief Impact Officer, for an app that connects people with coaches to improve their mental health and unlock potential in the workplace. It's a very sort of corporate focused app called BetterUp. They're based in San Francisco, founded in 2013, valued at $1.73 billion, Maggie. But they have taken on Harry in this very special role, one that they've created for him, to basically join their team, and as well as sort of advocating for the platform and the work that they do, to be involved in product development, and he will join the meetings. It's very hands-on. For Harry, this is kind of a step forward in the mental health work that he's already been doing. You know, he established Heads Together with the Royal Foundation alongside William and Kate. More recently, he worked on a project called Head Fit, which was a sort of mental health, mobile first based app for the military community over here in the UK. It's sort of been officially taken on by the armed forces and the British military here. So he kind of knows what he's talking about. We've seen him really express an interest in Silicon Valley and also work in the sort of tech environment, and it seems like a very natural fit.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. You know, I think we often talk about working royals and what they do. And in a sense, you know, he's bringing all that same passion and knowledge that he has, you know, accumulated over the past 10 years or so as a working royal, and bringing it now to the U.S., to Silicon Valley, like you said, as Chief Impact Officer. And, you know, I know there was kind of some people asking, well, there's a lot of play around his title, right? There's been so much talk about what title he'll have, and now he's been given this one of Chief Impact Officer, and some people are saying, well, what does that really mean? But we know it's not totally unheard of, and people within the company, the CEO says that it's a very meaningful and meaty role. This is a real thing, and you know, the role of Chief Impact Officer is fairly common in nonprofits and places like Amnesty International USA, the United Way have them, and even some tech companies like Salesforce have Chief Impact Officers. So it's not just sort of a nonsense title, right? It's a real thing. And so what I'm curious about, Omid, is, you know, obviously we're all kind of remote working right now, but will he go into the office? I mean, will there be a day where he shows up and like has his ID card and he has to swipe in like everybody else, and then has, I don't know, a cubicle, or maybe he'll have a corner office, I don't know. But is he going to like actually be this working employee of this company?
Yeah, although he doesn't have to report to anyone directly, BetterUp have said that he will be expected to attend company events in the future, of course, when things are a little safer. And that will also include spending time at their headquarters in San Francisco. So he's very much going to be doing a commute like millions of other Americans, perhaps not as often. And he's also expected to be in all the sort of all hands meetings that the company has. And, you know, this is something that Harry had actually kind of had some awareness of before even considering taking on a role with them. I think he was put in touch with their CEO last winter, and he then signed up to the app himself to spend a couple of months working with one of their coaches that the same coaches that everyone else has access to really experience what it was like for himself. And, you know, he says, he wrote for their blog this week, he said, I was matched with a truly awesome coach who's given me sound advice and a fresh perspective. And because we believe in strengthening our own mental health fitness, our entire Archwell team has also had access to Better Up coaching. So he's tried this within his own workforce, clearly liked how what it's all about. And it is a very sort of mental health focused app or service that they offer. But his role will really see him not only increasing the awareness of it, but of course taking it to a more global stage. At the moment, BetterUp is very much a US company, but of course Harry is someone that is incredibly well connected. I'm sure he's a great coup for the company. In fact, you know, I think they've obviously done pretty good to grow to the size that they have already. But at this point, this is kind of when you take on almost a brand ambassador in a way, someone that can speak about the sort of holistic side of the app and what they're about, someone who's also had experience with it. And of course, as we know, this is a subject that is very near and dear to Harry. I think he was always keen to continue his advocacy for mental health issues once he settled. So this is Harry's way of almost sort of reaching out or connecting to workforces across the country. You know, BetterUp already worked closely with Chevron, through the Hilton Group, through Salesforce.com. They've just signed a partnership with NASA. So it's a big deal. And in fact, ABC News caught up with their CEO, Alexis Robichaud, who, as you can imagine, is pretty much skipping around after the news of Harry's hire went public.
I was fortunate enough to meet Prince Harry through a mutual friend who had an inclination that, given our shared passion for mental fitness and really changing the conversation around mental health to focus on prevention and building strengths, we would hit it off. And so he talked to Harry about BetterUp, and Prince Harry was very excited, I think, and just impressed that someone in the world was doing this work in a startup setting using technology. He's obviously done a lot of similar missions and a lot of similar work in the nonprofit sphere. And so we were able to build a relationship and start talking. And I think we're both just really captivated by the opportunity to partner and give more voice and more momentum to the work we're doing here at BetterUp. It was a set of conversations. We spent a lot of time just getting to know one another. He was very interested in my personal journey and why myself and my incredible co-founder, Eddie, had started the company and what brought to that. And obviously, I knew more about him than he knew about me going into the conversation, but it was amazing to hear about his journey and give voice to so many of these things we've read about in his life for so many years. And, you know, I think at the core, we just organically circled around the mission of BetterUp is bigger actually than BetterUp as a company, right? Our mission is to help people worldwide flourish and to use technology and science and human wisdom to unlock and enable that. And we were just really excited at the prospect of partnering and how we could use BetterUp as a vehicle together to advance that mission and help millions, if not billions, of people live their best lives. So he's a senior leader on the team. He's actually an officer of the corporation, so a senior executive. There's four major areas that he will be partnering with us and where he'll be directing his energies and efforts. And the first is around what we've talked up here a bit about, which is how do we change the global conversation around mental health to really be focused that mental health is health. And when we are performing, when we're flourishing, when we're at our best, that means we're healthy. And we realize that for our own success as BetterUp to achieve our mission, we need to be part of many organizations, but at the forefront of advancing that story and changing that global dialogue. And so driving advocacy, global awareness, thought leadership, giving voice to his story and our story is one area that he'll be helping with. The second is actually in helping through partnerships and charities and social impact endeavors. And so we're actually very excited today to also share our partnership with Peak State, which is a mental fitness organization that will be co-creating and developing special practice activities and content for our members or users to use to improve their mental fitness and mental toughness. And then the third area is actually related to strategy and vision. So he's been very helpful on things related to product strategy, product positioning as well. And then fourthly, he'll also be helping, as you can imagine, as a leader of the organization with business development, partnership building in our ecosystem, with everything from our members to our customers to our coaches. So those are the four areas that comprise what we're calling the chief impact officer role. One of the things that really impressed me in getting to know him over the past couple months has been that certainly he comes from a particular background and he's a very well-known person globally. But actually, his greatest contributions is who he is as a person, his character, his integrity, his creative potential. He has had this incredible set of life experiences that are storied and many of us only read about. But to his, you know, what's been amazing talking to him is he's really put in the work to go through so many human growth and transformation moments. And that's what we look for in leaders. We look for leaders who have walked on the path themselves and are able to lead and help others on that same path. Ultimately, that's what we're here to do as a company. And so when I say I'm excited and we're excited to partner with Prince Harry, we're excited because of those insights, that vision, and those creative contributions, first and foremost, before anything else.
I think this is a really exciting time for Harry because, you know, we've seen him take on big roles before. He's obviously started up the Invictus Foundation. You know, I think he's proved himself in that space. But this is perhaps a slightly more traditional role. It's not a royal patronage. He's not working sort of in the name of the Queen. He's not there as HRH, the Duke of Sussex. It's kind of like Harry in the workplace. And I think for him, he's sort of living this series of firsts now. He's really able to sort of experience life outside palace walls in a way that I think he's probably wanted to for a long time. And of course, it's another feather in his cap, but not the only feather this week, because we also had the news that he's joined a six-month commission on media misinformation with the Aspen Institute. This is something that he does alongside, or the co-chairs of, include Katie Couric, Colour of Change President Rashad Robinson, and the former CISA director, Chris Krebs. So he joins 15 other commissioners for a six-month commission focused on the state of American misinformation and disinformation. And, you know, of course, I think we've heard Harry really hone in on this sort of crisis of information that he's often spoken about in recent months. And that, of course, not only is something that affects their lives, but we've seen really challenge democracy in itself at times, especially in the most recent election. There was, of course, a real, perhaps not enough of, but a concerted effort across many sort of platforms to ensure that people were accessing trustworthy information. And whilst I think readers are becoming a little savvier to what to, you know, for what to read and believe and what to not trust, a lot more needs to be done across sort of government roles, media, within the private sector, and so on. So this commission, which I believe starts in April, will see them working alongside experts in all of these fields to find recommendations for how America can respond to what they call this modern day crisis of faith in key institutions. And so we've seen, I think, Harry's joining a few people he already knows. Catherine Murdoch, Rupert's daughter-in-law, is in that. Former Texas Congressman Will Hurd. The UCLA professor and author Safia Noble, who Archwell are already working with on sort of tech-based work, is part of that as well. So this is, again, Harry really, I guess, taking a step outside of what we really are used to seeing him do. And I think for him, again, I think to have that freedom to do something that perhaps he wasn't able to do, because it's a little bit of a touchy subject, especially for an institution over here that is so sort of in a relationship with the media, he can sort of take these risks like he never could before.
You know, it's interesting, both of these new jobs, if you want to, you know, phrasing it like that, they're both focused on things he are obviously is passionate about and has been working on for quite some time. I mean, disinformation, as we just heard about in the Oprah interview, Meghan and Harry speaking out quite a bit about how the tabloids would spread lies about them and, you know, alleging that much of it was not true. And so I think it's really empowering that he's now, you know, using his new role and platform in a way to tackle these huge issues in a new way. And, you know, Omid, what I also think is interesting, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, is, you know, getting a new job and a new appointment like this in America, I feel like it really ties him to America. I mean, his new job, as you were saying, at BetterUp is for an American company in Silicon Valley. And, you know, this new media organization he's also working for is addressing a lot of issues in American media and in global as well. But, you know, these are American companies. And it really feels as if he's tying himself to America in a sense. Mm. He's like really laying some roots down there with his family.
It's been very interesting because this week behind the scenes, we've had some developments within the Archwell company in itself. They announced that their sort of former sort of UK communications officer is now moving into a role executive director of the Archwell Foundation, which means that their principal media team is now solely US based. And we're seeing them kind of build this team around them that is very US focused and US centric. Mm. And, you know, in fact, this week we had pretty cool news actually. They've hired producer Ben Browning as the head of content for Archwell Productions and Archwell Audio. So that's to work alongside these partnerships with Netflix and Spotify. And, you know, Browning's most recently been nominated for Golden Globe, Academy Award for the Best Picture nominee for Promising Young Women. And this is sort of them, again, I guess, solidifying their place in the US landscape. Of course, a lot of this stuff that they're sharing with the world through these various platforms will be available to everyone. But as you say, the life that they're creating for themselves and the work that they're doing is very much in America. And I think that shows where perhaps they found somewhere that they are more comfortable. I don't know about you, but it feels to me that divisive sort of like or dislike feeling that the British public have towards the couple doesn't really exist in America in that same way.
I think that we've talked about this quite extensively, but there is this huge divide. And, you know, part of it is just the culture of growing up with a monarchy or not. And, you know, part of it is also cultural differences. But there does seem to be a lot more openness, I think, in America to the idea of Harry and Meghan having these other jobs and pursuing them in a way that just may have been more difficult, you know, because of the history of the monarchy in the UK.
Well, it hasn't all been focused on Harry this month in the Sussex camp. Meghan also popped up this week in the form of a cake. When she provided a sweet surprise for a group of women in Chicago in honor of Women's History Month. She, according to sources close to Meghan, she provided a homemade olive oil cake made with lemons from her own garden at their Montecito home as part of a meal in partnership with World Central Kitchen. And of course, this is part of their ongoing commitment to engaging in acts of compassion throughout the month of March. If you listen to last week's episode, you'll remember Maggie and I running through some of those.
She sent
this note over to this group of women in Chicago. It says, "We hope you enjoyed the offering we baked for you." Like, I'll come back to that in a second. She says, "A small token of thanks from our home to you. Our hope is with this effort is to show that when we all participate, even the smallest actions can have a ripple effect. Even individual actions can impact the whole of us." Hmm. Now, the thing that stood out to me in that, other than it being a lovely note, we bake.
I know, I was like, so, who's she baking with?
All the reports talk about Meghan making a cake, but, you know, it's possible that Harry was the star in the kitchen.
What I like to think.
The World Central Kitchen tweet threw me off because it says the dessert was a... They said that they worked with Archwell to provide meals and share a message of appreciation and support in Chicago. And they said dessert was lemon olive oil cake baked by the Duchess. Duchess and Harry.
Duchess and Harry. In my mind, I'm picturing the two of them, like Harry in his apron in the kitchen and like Archie's on the counter with his wooden spoon, like helping them stir. Do you think that's accurate? This is my mind of what's happening in Montecito right now.
I think that sounds about right. You know, that Lifetime announced this week that they were making a third Harry and Meghan movie.
Really?
So I don't know if you've just given them inspiration.
You're
for
all
a
welcome.
Scene.
I picture Archie like tossing them a lemon. He's old enough for that now, right? And you know, Harry zesting it over the lemon cake. I'm also interested in the cake choice. I feel like that cake choice is very fitting for the couple.
Olive oil, I don't know about you, olive oil cake is one of my favorites.
Really?
It's also the only cake I know how to make. I'm gluten-free and dairy-free.
Okay. So what's an olive oil cake then?
I make it with, or I have made it with, almond flour.
Okay, that makes sense.
And like the zest of a lemon, and then olive oil, and lots of egg whites.
Really? So you That's literally almost like a power bar.
A what? Sorry.
I feel like it's like a breakfast bar. It's like egg whites, almond flour, and olive oil.
It's like you're eating a salad, Omid. Well, no, you beat the egg whites until it's almost like a meringue.
Oh, like a meringue. Okay.
And then you add in all the other stuff I said, and then you put that in the oven. So I think you fold it in.
Oh.
I'm talking like a professional.
I know, you really are. Everyone join Omid and Maggie's cooking class. We bake on Tuesdays, and there's no directions, and there's no ingredient list. You just got to follow along real fast. Hope everyone's taking notes.
Yeah, this pandemic has done all sorts to me. I had never baked in my life, but this was definitely a favorite. So
I want to try this one now. Well, thank you, Megan. Thank you, Omid, for the inspiration.
But of course, this does highlight the work that World Central Kitchen have been doing throughout this entire pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think they've so far served over 500,000 meals.
It's really incredible. It's a huge number.
Since the beginning. And apparently, according to one of the women, I think they met at a restaurant in the Fat Shallot restaurant in the city's Lincoln Park area. She said that the cake was delicious.
I mean, would you expect anything less?
But before we go, Maggie, there is one item that I know will send you into the weekend smiling.
This is the best weekend news I've ever heard. We've been waiting for this.
We have, you know, and I feel like this is almost a response to our request on the podcast a couple of weeks ago when we revealed the news. We revealed the news that the Queen had taken on two puppies throughout the pandemic, like many others who have taken on dogs or pets throughout the past year. The Queen's lone final dog, Candy, which was her single remaining dog up until the summer of last year, now has two friends. One called, are you ready for this?
I'm Fergus. So ready. I love it.
And apparently the name, this is the Sun reporting this, but Buckingham Palace have quietly confirmed it via sources. They say that the name Fergus comes from the Queen's uncle, Fergus Bowes Leon,
who
was killed in action during World War I.
Wow.
So a nice little honourable mention there. Doggy number two, also a Dorgie, so that's a Dachshund Corgi mix. That's kind
Most
of the direction the Queen's gone with her dogs in recent years, is reportedly named Muck. No.
Oh, okay, well, this one's confusing. It's spelled like muck. It's spelled M-U-I-C-K. But according to our sources, it's pronounced Mick. But I want to hear the Queen say it before I can really confirm this.
That makes sense. And I feel like I've let down my Scottish roots because it's actually named after Loch Mick on the Balmoral Estate, which is a large lake there. So I should have known that.
We won't judge
But of course, that's where the Queen spends a lot of her summer holidays. So yeah, I'm sure I'd be curious to know if Prince Philip knew about the puppies.
Interesting.
Before he came home, or did he just arrive?
Well, you know, my husband's always lives in fear. He's going to come home one day and there's just like puppies in our house. But I got them and now we have puppies. I wonder if that's what the Queen did. Like, Philip, welcome home. We have two new Dorgies. I don't know what to tell you. They just showed up and now we have four more puppies.
Best day ever.
I want to leave with my dream. Can they please make Instagram accounts for Fergus and Mick? That's all. That's my parting desire.
Listen, manifest it, put it out there. We begged for the names of these dogs. We have them now. I feel like it could happen.
Someone's listening, Omid.
Well, that takes us to the end of the ride this week. Thanks, as always, for listening. Big up to the guys in New York at ABC Audio, including Anthony Alley, for pulling the show together. If you want to reach out to us, you can tweet myself and Maggie on Twitter at Maggie Rooley or at Scobie. Just use the hashtag TheAirPod. And Maggie, if you are up for it, will you join me next Friday for the next episode?
I am so excited. And by then I will have made and eaten and maybe given away as my act of compassion a olive oil cake in your honor.
Oh, okay, fine.
That's my goal.
All right. Well, on that note, take care, guys.
Bye, everyone.